Attention painters, are you sick and tired of dealing with semi-reliable staff? Do you feel like you need to be on site all day because you can't trust your crew to do their damn job? Well, the reality is you probably have an accountability problem. And the bad news is you're babysitting your crews so much, it's hard to tell if you're running a painting business or a daycare. The good news is though, improving performance with your team is surprisingly easy to fix. Yes, even in your location and with your team size. Join me for a special web class July 8th. Where we'll show you how to eliminate all staff excuses, bringing one structured 30-minute meeting to life. This is gonna help you cultivate a reliable team without awkward conversations, conflicts, or festering resentment. July 8th, be there or be square. Click the link in the description. Let's register now and make it happen. Hey everyone, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. As entrepreneurs, we're constantly learning how to lead others, how to manage our people, how to set direction for our business, and the overall important systems that need to be in place for our team. But how often do we take time to learn how to lead ourselves? Today, I'm talking with special guest Keith Mercutio. Keith is a plumber turned speaker and executive coach. He's the CEO and founder of Ethical Influence Global and does a significant amount of work with our friends over at ServiceTitan. As a leader of leaders, Keith knows that our ability to serve others is rooted in our ability to understand ourselves. In this episode, Keith and I unpack the strategies for self-leadership, self-awareness, spirituality, and how to show up just with no ego in our daily lives. I really loved this conversation and learned a lot even for myself, and I hope you do too. Let's get started. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Keith, welcome to the show, my friend.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I see you got the memo on the beige shirt for the day.
Yep. Yeah, you said no bright colors, Keith. We don't want you to stand out in any way. Taupe is the color of the day.
No one can see this, but we're literally wearing almost the exact same shirt. So those who can on YouTube, it's anyways, this is a good start.
Yeah.
I'm stoked to talk to you.
So you too.
This will go down for me anyways as the fastest, you know, meet you to start a podcast. I think we met last night, had a quick chat, and we're just like, tomorrow morning, let's do this. So I appreciate so your quick reaction time.
Welcome to the world. And I think your teammate said that it took like a year or something to get a hold of me, and then I asked if we could record the next day. Yeah, so
she commented on this. She's like, I spent a whole year and you just book them in like in a couple hours. I was like, I don't know, just Keith's a good dude, we want to talk. So anyways, good man.
Happy to be here.
I threw some notes together. We can go through it. We can go through some. I know you and I have a bunch in common that I'd love to talk to and just get your thoughts even on just what you do and where it applies to not only our listeners, but there's some stuff I think you want to ask me. So we'll get into that too. But let's just start by letting everybody know who you are. Like you're an executive coach. Is that right? Like there's a life that's led to what you're doing today. You're working with ServiceTitan's leadership team, I think executive team as well. Maybe just give us a bit of a walkthrough of what you've been up to and how you got to this place.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think the story starts in the simplest version. I'm a college dropout turned plumber. I spent my 20s plumbing for a company in Boston area, Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Winters Plumbing. It was my next door neighbor. I took a job as an apprentice with him and kind of worked my way up, and I got into the business side of that company and, you know, really appreciated sort of, you know, they were forward thinking at the time and they joined an organization called Nexstar, which was the minute I got exposed to their training, I said, that's what I want to do with my life right there. I didn't even know it existed. And it was just, I saw these guys, Dave Bodick and Bob Hamilton, and I just Lewis Williams. And I said, that's my future. And when I was around 30 years old, I got hired as their lead coach, or excuse me, first sales trainer. And then worked my way up in that organization. I became their director of training, and I spent 8 years in that position and with Nexstar. And during that time, Nexstar was the coaching organization to nearly 1,000 plumbing, heating, cooling, electrical contracting companies. And we were working on the business side, the in-home service side, the customer experience, customer service reps, and of course, you know, the leadership. And I fell in love with, you know, kind of two separate disciplines, like the art and science of influence and then the art and science of facilitation. And I was obsessed with those two things. And in that, you know, it helped build out our curriculums. And I was traveling 45 weeks a year, training 3 days a week in shops and businesses. And eventually really honed my focus on the leadership side. And so back in, 2019, August of 2019, I left Nexstar to start my career as a public speaker. And by March of 2020, gathering in public was illegal. And so I pivoted and created a coaching business that has now flourished alongside the speaking side of things. And it's just my joy. So I coach two teams ongoing, the Service Titan team, as well as a longtime friend and an incredible organization out of Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is the Blanton's Home Services, Will and Shanna Blanton. So those are my two coaching teams that I work with. And then I speak at events. And that's kind of, I think, my quickest career synopsis I could give you.
So you started a public speaking business in 2020.
Yeah. Just going. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was impeccable timing. Yeah.
Quick pivot in, quick pivot out. That's interesting. And does a lot of this feel very meant to be, I would say? Like, just meeting you, you feel very centered. You feel very grounded. You feel very focused in who you are.
No, I'm glad. I'm glad that that's the impression that I get. I feel like I'm swirling, man. We can get into that, but I appreciate that. I can tell you for sure. I know, like, that the one thing that I have certainty around in my life is the work that I do. Like, I feel incredibly grounded in the work. The best way I can say it, you know, like, part of my joy in coaching and when I'm on stage is that it's the one time that I find myself not thinking about myself and, you know, just truly like present. And I think, you know, maybe different terms would be like in a flow state, you know, and not worried about how people are seeing me, perceiving me. Am I doing okay? Am I doing enough? It's like, I'm just so, I get in the most beautiful way, completely lost of self. And so, yeah, when it comes to my work, the coaching and the speaking, I feel like really, really clear that this is what I'm meant to do.
You're in your gift. You're doing what you're meant to be doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It is a gift. I mean, I don't mean getting to do the work is a gift. And it does feel like, you know, the truest sense of the term vocation.
There is something to that. I remember a course I took on this, but it was like, there are sacred gifts in all of us. And when you learn how to give those as a part of what you do every single day, it's not only effortless, but it brings you true fulfillment. And when you're not doing those things, that's where you start to, even if you're really good at some stuff, it doesn't mean that's your gift. There's certain things that is your gift, and that fills you up by just doing it every single day. So
couldn't agree more in that. You know, I mean, that's been something I've been really grateful for, because that's been there for me during, you know, a stretch when most everything else was not, you know, aligned and not working in what felt like a positive direction for me. So I've been, you know, really grateful to have this work to continue to lean into. It's been very special.
And I'm curious, because Service Titan is a well-known brand, especially in our industry. They are literally titans in this industry, and they're growing and they're doing a lot of really good things. What's been your experience working with that team, and what are you learning even just working with the exec team over there?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the fortunate positions that I was in was the ability to kind of, you know, because of the exposure that I'd had, great with gratitude to Nexstar and so on, and where I was at, I could kind of choose what I wanted to do next and anyone that I wanted to partner with. Service Titan was my first phone call. Vahe Kazoyan was my first phone call I made when I decided that I was going to sort of head out on my own. And I thought about who would I want to partner with and do something special with. I had met Ara and Vahe, I think back in 2013 or 2014, somewhere around there. We shared the common bond that I knew what an Armenian was, which blew them away. And that's because I grew up in Watertown, Massachusetts, where we had the second highest concentration of Armenians in the country, next to Glendale, California, where they're located and where they immigrated to. And we worked together in partnership at Nexstar for years, and I had such a deep admiration of them and friendship with them that it was clear, you know, who they were as people. And that's the beauty was they always treated me as a friend, as an equal. And that's how they treat people, regardless of their extraordinary success. I mean, it's absolutely stunning what they've created. And so what I get to witness that I think has really stood out to me is two things about them that I find unique, although among the best leaders, it's a pattern. One is that they're remarkably open to coaching, like stunningly open to coaching. At any point in time, if I text Dara and say, hey, can we jump on a call? He will text me back within minutes and ensure that we do and say, what do you got, big man? And he wants to hear it, receive it, process it, and then he puts it to use if he is in alignment, right? It's the beauty of coaching is that you don't have to do anything with it. But additionally, they're also completely values-based, character-based. Like the same conversations that they have in the background would be perfectly consumable for the public. Like there's no difference in the way that they speak to their employees, the way that they speak to their customers, the way that they speak to Wall Street, compared to how they speak when they're in a room where only their audience or I happen to be able to listen. And I find that just so uplifting, like, and it creates a lot of hope about a leadership team.
And what you're speaking to, I think about this all the time. It's like, man, when a business gets bigger, it has to lose its heart and we all have to get really rigid and we have to be able to do hard things behind closed doors and then come out and do that to the team. And it's like, but you're saying that's not true, especially for Service Titan. And that's part of their success.
Yeah. So like they continue to be remarkably clear in what they're doing. And they, you know, Ara speaks to it. And this is important for leaders to get, like he repeats this hundreds of times a year in public settings and private settings. He'll talk about the fact that the number one thing is our customer success. When our customers are successful, we're successful. And that is 100% true, right? I mean, as they grow in revenue, add technicians, add, you know, services, we grow. I mean, as a SaaS company, right? As a, you know, software as a service company, we're able to experience growth alongside of our clients, of our customers. So he's phenomenally clear that what got us here will get us there, which isn't always the case, but it is in ours, in that continuing to put the customer success as our number one North Star is exactly the path to take. And then you have Vahe, who talks about the fact, you know, now that we're a public company, it can be easy to want to start to focus on your shareholders, right? Mm-hmm. And what Vahe says is, I just heard that he was just quoted yesterday, and I texted him. I said, dude, I just heard you quoted on this. Please continue to repeat this in perpetuity. He said, we're here to serve our owners, not our short-term renters. Those, whether they're the customer, whether they're the employee or the shareholder who's prepared to be with us for the long term, that's what we're building towards.
Interesting.
And that's who we want to stay focused on. Is this in the long-term interest of our customers? Is this in the long-term interest of our investors? Not the immediacy of the market and reactivity. And that's what just gives me such incredible joy in working with these two men, is they're so perfectly focused on and unwavering on what the North Stars are.
Unwavering is a really good word for this, because what you just said makes sense. It's not like anyone listening to this would be like, oh, wow, I never thought of that before. It's the challenges and the headwinds that you face when you start to get larger, when you go public, that requires will and determination and a clarity in who you are and who you want to stay to become. So good for them. That's cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what they also, there's a couple other things that they possess. I mean, they, you know, their culture, their family gives them that deep, like rooted, you know, background or depth of loyalty, conviction, you know, I would even dare say courage, because you have to make difficult decisions in order to stay in that unwavering path. Like that's not an easy path. That's a very difficult path. And so, you know, there's that piece of it. And there's also the fact that they are, you know, that they're deeply trusting in, you know, a few people that have shown them the way, right, and have guided them. And so their willingness to accept mentorship, which I want to be clear, I'm not including myself in that. By the way, anybody that calls themselves a mentor is not a mentor. I'm convinced of that. You can only be asked to mentor someone. You can't volunteer to mentor someone. That's just a side note. Can I swear on this podcast?
You can say whatever you want, man. You can do whatever you want.
Oh, thank God. I that was the first time I just got caught and like I could barely get that sentence out because there was meant to be a swear in front of it.
Juan might beep you out, but you can swear.
Thank you. So, you know, I think that's the other piece of it is that they just have this unique ability to see, you know, in others what they can learn from and then take it and go with it.
You just said something, and I read this before we got into this, but you believe in this thing called opt-in coaching where people need to want this. Or explain this more to me. Like, what is opt-in coaching and why is that a non-negotiable for you and the people you work with?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I've coached and trained enough folks and to know that you have to want and be seeking of coaching to truly be, I think, of, you know, the full experience of it and the advantage of it. If you're not seeking it and it's being forced upon you, there's going to be a natural resistance to it. And if you think about it, like a lot of the assignments that I used to receive and sort of had to accept, especially at Nexstar and things like that, because we're a member owned organization, you know, were things like, you know, I need you to train my team. Like I need to get them bought in, or I need you to, you know, hey, we're having trouble with this person over here. They need some coaching. That's being assigned a tutor because you're failing. Right. Or, you know, in the other instance, if I hear an owner or a leader tell me that their team needs the training, as opposed to saying, hey man, I need some coaching and training. Like I can't seem to get through to the team. That's a completely different conversation. And so one of the big flags that I see for owners and leaders when they reach out to me is if they say, hey, I want you to train my team, or I want you to work with my managers or my executives, you know, but they're not seeking for themselves. And, you know, once upon a time in my career, I had to say yes to that regardless. And I could encourage them, but, you know, now I can simply say, hey, unless this is for you first and them second, it's not going to work with the style of work that I do, because I am asking people to confront the sides of themselves, the realities about self, the non-conscious, the subconscious that, you know, are selfish motives, like the stuff that we're not super proud of, that's a little bit, you know, like that we don't like to admit is true about us, that's causing us to be less effective, less influential, less in our integrity than we'd like to be. And so it requires a seeker who wants to and is willing to and has the courage to say, hey, I want to see these things, because I know that in seeing them, it'll help me become a more effective leader in person.
Yeah, I see this with a lot of our members coming in. Not a lot, but some of them are requesting, like, can you just work with our team? And I know it's like, if it goes bottom up, you're going to, two things can happen. One, what you just described, which is the people that are being coached are just, they're not paying for this and they're not into it. And so like, it doesn't really go anywhere. Or almost bigger, you do get traction with them, but you know, now you create misalignment between the owner and the person that you're coaching, because they're on a different page. They're not both working on the same things, leading the same direction.
So it's so funny because there's a neighbor of mine who, so if you can imagine this, like you've heard my resume, right? I've probably trained more technicians. I think it might be safe to say there might be a few people, Thad David maybe at this point has surpassed me, but there's a decent chance that I've trained more technicians than anybody in the world. Like if you consider those 8 years, 45 weeks a year training technicians, like it's very possible, right? Worked with 1,000, you know, companies building curriculums on how to run an HVAC plumbing electrical business. My neighbor has an HVAC business here locally, $6 million a year business. And he's talking to me one day. He has no idea who I am, no idea what I do or what my background is. And of course, I don't even really focus in the trades anymore per se. Like that's not, you know, I'm agnostic of industry now. It's still part of it, but not really. But anyway, he's telling me his story. Can you imagine like hearing somebody, you know, in that position? I'm listening to him talk about how his team doesn't get it and his partner doesn't get it and everything. And the ego in me wants to just be like, dude,
I'm right here.
Google me. Yeah. Google me. It's like, this is like a pitcher who's, you know, like blaming, you know, everything else. And, you know, one of the top pitching coaches in the country is standing in front of him. And I'm sitting there going, hey, man, if you want to come over for a drink and talk about some of this stuff, I'd be happy to. He's like, yeah, maybe, you know, like maybe we'll do. And I'm just like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, what, you know, how do I? And it's, you cannot help someone who's not ready to seek. Like, they just can't do it. And you can use force, you use coercion. And of course, I tried to sort of tell him a little bit, you know, to what has happened. But it's, you have to be ready for that. I mean, it's that, I hate trite phrases, but, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Like, this man is literally standing in front of exactly the person that he's thinks he needs, but his heart isn't open yet, and so he can't even see it.
The openness is interesting. I struggle with this too sometimes. I'm a very open person by nature, but you do get to a point where you're inundated by people wanting to give you help or give you this advice or give you this. And eventually you start saying no to things. And I do have a bit of anxiety around it where I'm just like, I just want to be able to say yes to everything, but at least look into everything a little bit, just to understand where things are on the other side. And how do I kind of like regulate what I'm open to, what I'm not? Because especially as you grow, like, there's a lot of people that say they're going to come and help you, but you can't tell right away. And you don't always have time to investigate.
That's so fair.
Person.
No, that, you know what? That's really fair. Actually, thank you. Cause that's a great perspective to consider is, you know, of course I'm only thinking of myself in front of this man and like, oh, like, but I am.
It is a hilarious coincidence though.
But yeah, I know it's hysterical. But to that point, who knows how many hundreds of people have told them they had the answer before.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's a great perspective to consider. And so here's what I would, you know, share in that regard is that I heard a phrase a long time ago that it's one of the things I invite the audience into, or, you know, people who consider themselves skeptics. I invite them to just be open-minded skeptics.
Cool.
To be curiously minded skeptics. And in that, yeah, continue to have your doubt and your concern, but just be curious about it as opposed to shut off to it. And for those who are naturally curious and open, add the skeptical part.
Yeah.
Like, it's a good position to be in.
You know what, Keith? I see this on the opposite side where people they drink the Kool-Aid too much and they get way too into it, and they're going to go 10x their business next year as a result. And they have no idea the shitstorm they're about to create for themselves. But because someone on stage told them that, or they met a really smart person in a cool conversation, they get overconfident in something that they really haven't done, like you said, the work in to be able to do that properly.
Yeah. I mean, that's that premise of, you know, potentially toxic positivity too, where you become so absolutely certain of what you can and will create and the outcomes that are going to take place, but there's not a practical path. And so it is a blend, right? I mean, we do have to understand that positivity, open-mindedness, curiosity, you know, believing that good things are happening for you. I mean, these are scientifically proven to be critical as far as what you actually do see, the energy that you do attract. I mean, those are real. And there are people that are consistently, fairly delusionally, you know, optimistic that can't see the truth of what they need to deal with in front of them as well. And so and I wouldn't call it a balance because in an individual, I don't want to take away their optimism. And you're not going to add practicality to somebody who's constantly seeing the best in things. But what you can do is if that person is open to hearing a solid perspective from someone whose strength is, for example, pragmatism, then you start to create a nice blend between two people who are willing to listen to one another. And that's how you build a team that thinks of, you know, that leverages everybody's strengths.
You're also just talking about being conscious, being present. You said the word critical thinking. There's something to that. And I think sometimes, especially when we're real busy, we turn some of those parts of our brain off because we're just trying to go and do something and we need to like ignore all this other stuff. But it's like, if you're just present to the conversation and you actually pay attention to what people are saying to you, you can start to have that critical thinking, kind of like, what would you call it? Like skepticism with open-mindedness kind of in each other, because you're investigating. You're with, like, when I met you last night, I was just like, this guy's smart. He's super cool. I really want to meet with him. I don't even know who you are. It was super interesting, but I clicked into it right away because I wanted to know you. Right. And it made a big difference, I think, even for both of us to connect to do this podcast right now. So anyway.
No, I felt, and I, by the way, thank you. I really appreciate hearing that. That's like, you know, it's very fulfilling to hear. And same, which is why I was so quick to say, all right, let's do this thing. You know, but something to that point is I think probably the most under-practiced, under-taught, underutilized, and I'm using a superlative here, the most underutilized or underappreciated skill set in leadership is listening. And really in humanity, because it's what you're listening for, right? And so, like, there's some remarkable science around this, you know, I mean, but the quickest example I can give anybody is if you're in a crowded room, right, where there's, you know, white noise, a million conversations going on, you're at a party, you're at a restaurant, whatever else, there's one word that you can hear from across the room that breaks through all the white noise every single time, and it's your own name,
right?
If somebody across that room mentions your name, you'll hear them mention your name. And this is indicative of the fact that, like, the non-conscious is processing 11 million bits of data per second. But there's this mechanism called the reticular activating system that determines out of those 11 million, what 50 bits of data get through and that make it into the conscious mind. So it's this, like, incredible filtration system. And what it is actually the original algorithm. It's the human algorithm. And what makes it through is what's important to us. We hear what's important to us.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're listening for determines what we hear, literally. This isn't like a philosophical concept. This is a literal scientific concept of how what we listen for determines what we hear. Our brain knows our name is important. So as a result, in that room, the name makes it through to the conscious mind amongst all this white noise. It wasn't any louder. It wasn't said differently. It wasn't even said at us. And so that anecdote is incredibly helpful for people. If how we listen with intentionality will determine what we hear. And so if we've already got our opinion made up, if we've got our mind made up, if we're trying to, for example, get somebody bought in, or if we're in sales and we're trying to get somebody to say yes, everything we're listening to it through the filter of how do I get this person to this outcome? Mm. And as a result, we're missing massive amounts of information, critical information as to what's important to this person, why it might be important to this person. You know, I was coaching a friend yesterday, and I was listening to her tell me the story that she's in a negotiation regarding, you know, her salary and a position. She's in a relatively new company. And she said like four times, you know, that they kept emphasizing like, yeah, but this is a director position. She's like, right, but I'm a VP. And so after I heard her story, I just shared with her. I said, you know, I really think that you should take a look at and ask the question, hey, you've now mentioned four times this is a director role. Tell me why that's so important and what it is I need to know about that. Because what they're both doing is wanting to assert this is a director role, and she's wanting to assert, yes, but I'm a VP. But neither one knows why that's so important to the other. They're making assumptions about it.
Yeah, they're laying each other's agendas into it. It's just like, this is my agenda, this is my agenda. And it's like, no one's communicating.
Exactly. And just one simple question to delineate, like, why is that so important? Like, I've heard you say that four times now. That must be important. Now, it's not what I want to hear, right? In her role, she doesn't want to keep hearing this is a director role. So she's wanting to convince otherwise of, yeah, but I'm not. I'm a VP. But now she can go find out. And maybe it's because they think that that's a budgetary concern. Maybe it's because they think it's the scope of work. Maybe it's because they're afraid of having too many VPs. And she might even be right in her assumption as to why. But the willingness and courage to hear something that you don't want to hear, that doesn't suit your outcome, and then go explore that thing openly, curiously, is like what truly, in my mind, you know, like creates a distinction among the great and effective leaders, listeners, and influencers. And so, you know, I'm glad you let me run on that. I think it's one of the most important topics that we can explore. But this willingness to get intentional about what am I listening for?
Yeah. You know what I think about when you say that? I used to do this in specifically sales, but this is true when I'm working with anyone on my team, really. It's just when I see somebody or meet somebody, my vision of them is a stick person, and that is it, on a white piece of paper. And as I talk to them, I'm adding you know, a girth to them. I'm adding a look to them. I'm adding until I get to like a 3D photorealistic image of who this person is and what they're all about. And I try my best not to start with that image. So even though I'm physically looking at them, I'm like, no, you're just a stick person right now. You could be the king of the world or you could be a homeless guy. I have no idea. I don't really care. I just want to get to know you. And then once I start to know that, I can start to add the details on because I've actually taken the time to understand and not assume. Because there's a lot of assumptions we make based on visual cues, based on first impressions. And I'm kind of like, I don't know, like some of the coolest people I've ever met, like impression wise, didn't really like from across the room look like the person I should sit down with. But man, did I learn a lot just by being like, you're a stick human to me. Let's talk.
Okay. So this is absolutely brilliant. Like I love this. I've never heard this before. And well done. This is a fascinating premise of, you know, clearing the canvas for someone and letting them show you who they are and tell you who they are. And because the opposite is typically true, that we immediately author our own story about somebody upon meeting them. And then, you know, I think what would be amazing beyond that would be the willingness to, because once we get to know somebody, then we start to stack our story on top of them in a way that can create a lot of baggage sometimes, where we immediately assume when someone says something, because we have past experience with them, we already know, you know, what's important to them. We know why they're bringing this. We know what their motives are. And as a result, we end up like being much more open listeners to total strangers than we are to the people that we love or that we work closest to. And so what occurs to me as well is the willingness to like erase those, you know, those additions and put somebody back in that stick figure form when it's an important conversation to give them the chance to tell you what's really coming up for them in that moment. I'll be stealing that.
Good.
The first time I'll give you credit. The second time it'll be some guy I know. And the third time it'll have been my
idea. It'll be trademarked.
So that's amazing.
Danny Kerr's 18-year-old brain, I think, when I was trying to learn sales and I was just kind of like, how do I do this? I was a really bad salesman. I had a lot of trouble because I didn't listen at first. I was very pigheaded in how I approached things and I needed to really calm that down. So
who broke through to help you do that?
I had a coach. I had a business coach, actually. So, and he basically walked me through a lot of like what I've had a few coaches in my life, but he was like the first one when I was 18 years old and kind of like gave me the baseline of how I should perceive things in life. So
what was the person's name?
Joe Cunliffe.
All right.
Joe Cunliffe.
Gotta give these people shout outs. I think.
There you go.
Yeah. It's important. I mean, regardless of, you know, whatever the role, if they had that kind of a positive effect, it's a beautiful thing to say their name.
Yeah, he always challenged me. I think I've said this before on the podcast, but I remember there was a time, this was more about just being open-minded than just people, but I was like, this cannot be done. It was like start of our production season. I had 3 painters quit out of the 6 that I had. And I had like a month's worth of work for 6 people, but I only had 3 working. And we were up on like a 32-foot ladder trying to paint the top of like some 40-foot gable and trim. And we couldn't reach it. And I called him and I'm like, I can't do this work. Like I've got no painters. I don't know how to do any of this. And he looked at me, he said, Danny, there has never been a thing that I haven't problem solved how to do. How much time have you asked yourself, how can I versus I can or I cannot? And that how can I question needs to come out first before I'm even going to like talk to you again. And he hung up on me.
Danny, I have the identical story.
Really?
And mine was Gino Cataldo. Mm-hmm. And I was on a plumbing project and I called him. I said, Gino, there's no way to get this done. And he said, Keith, there's always a way. Yeah. Figure it out. Yeah. And he hung up the phone.
Yeah.
That was and I haven't told that story in probably 10 years. And I forgot all about it until you just told me yours.
It's good. We've had good mentors in our life. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Gino was truly the most gifted plumber that I think he was the world's greatest plumber. I really do. And there were countless lessons that came from him, but that one had really resonated. And God, what a gift these people that challenge us and share, you know, an alternative way of thinking that becomes embedded.
Yeah, it becomes a part of our DNA.
How different is your life because of the number of times that you've asked the question, you know, how can I? How different is my life because I was taught there's always a way.
Right. Yeah, it creates us, man. I did not grow up in a world where I thought I'd be a business coach. I did not grow up in a world where I thought I'd run a big organization where that happens. I grew up in a world where I was living on welfare with my mom, just trying to figure out how to survive. And so there, you know, what's interesting for me, I didn't have very much mentorship for a lot of my life. And I didn't really know who to turn to or who to look up to or how to place any of that in me. And so I turned to God, was a big one. And I had a few influencers along the way that actually built into me. And it was this company similar to you. You grew up in the plumbing world. I grew up in the painting world in a franchise thing called College Pro Painters, but it like shifted who I was. And I went from this slack-jawed kid that was probably going to end up whatever, just causing trouble and getting, you know, getting in jail or who knows, to running a painting company with like a bunch of like really successful, cool young kids and a coach who like actually built into me for the first time ever. And yeah, I got perspective and I think I was craving it, but I didn't know how to receive it, where to go to even get it. So I fell into that and that made a big difference for me early on.
You know, that's what a gorgeous story. And, you know, Vahe, one of my favorite lines that I hear him say, he says, you can call me anything, but just never call me self-made.
Mm, right.
And this idea of acknowledging and appreciating, you know, I mean, that you'd spent those years. And I with that same friend yesterday on my conversation, I said, you know, one of the reasons that I feel like I'm swirling and just lost right now is I don't have a clear set of mentors like I have in the past.
You're talking about you right now.
And yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That I myself am struggling in knowing in my day to day, you know, where I'm headed. I don't have as clear a set of mentors as I have in the past. I'm very grateful. Ellen Rohr has entered my life in a new way as a mentor. She's just like this constant, remarkable person who's happening for me all the time, like always thinking about me, I swear, and ways that she can elevate me, help me, support me, you know, put me in a better position. And that's been a real gift. I've been super grateful for that. So I don't want to discount her. And certainly I admire the folks that I'm working with, but like that day in and day out, you know, witnessing of somebody, a leader that's really guiding and exemplifying, you know, a path, is something that I've noticed. It just I'm lacking, you know. It's a new world. I run my own little business. I coach these other companies, but I'm alone most of the day. You know, it's not, you're not in the office anymore. You're not witnessing other people. There's not the same camaraderie and learning going on. And so, yeah, man, I just think that's a really incredible story. If it's okay, I want to just point something out in the conversation that just drew my attention though. You know, when I got done talking about like how we listen, you said, you know what that makes me think of. And that's a perfect example of how we listen, right? Because human beings are pattern making machines. Mm-hmm. And so as we listen, we're not receiving the input directly of what someone else is saying. We're receiving an input, but in our own minds, we're having an internal conversation about what they're saying. Yep. And we're making meaning and creating a pattern recognition out of what they're saying. And so the way that human beings relate and typically communicate is whatever you just said made me think of something. And now I'm going to share what that made me think of. And by the way, it was beautiful, right? And it's also a good example of what's important to us is what comes to the surface is what we hear. So you heard something that connected to something that previously is of importance to you. That's the science of how we listen. And so, you know, to go back to that for a moment to share a premise of what's practically important is that if we can give up the outcome, give up being right, give up convincing this person, give up the sale, if we can give up the internal need to have a particular resolution to a conversation, if we can give up the desire to be liked, the desire to be impressive, the desire to be funny or attractive, if we can give those things up, that's how we can actually start to learn to listen with generosity. What can I contribute? What can I be present to? What can I offer? What can I share of self? What can I hear in this person that's important to them and acknowledge? When we start to ask a different question about, you know, what can I or how can I, it changes what we're tuned into from a frequency standpoint and what we actually do here. And so, you know, the first part was maybe a little scientific and philosophical about how the listening works, but I wanted to make sure that you or you know, anyone that might be listening hears how to practically start to listen differently and hear new things.
And I can imagine there's people that are naturally open-minded that would hear what you said and they're like, totally, that's really reinforcing. I appreciate it. And there's people that are listening to what you just said and said, are you nuts, Keith? Because now I'm just going to, I have no outcome. It's, things are just going to get out of control. Like, what do you say to that?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very fair. Thank you for representing those pains in the out there that are, no. So those are the skeptics, and those are the ones that I would remind to be curiously minded right now, right? Because I didn't say give up the outcome as in the outcome won't occur. But if we give up the need for the outcome, there's an old saying that I heard, that only when we give what it is we intended to get without the intent to get it will we ever get it. Mm. So if I'm constantly seeking validation, right, everything in me is motivated towards receiving that validation, and yet I'm likely to never fully feel validated because it's a constant search of mine. If I'm always transactional, right, then every relationship becomes and I'm always feeling that I'm in a deficit because I haven't had enough transactions. If it, like, whatever it is that I'm trying to get out of others, there's never going to be enough of it to satisfy me.
There's this thought I've had for a long time, and I've been noticing it in life, that life is literally ironic. And it's not that it's sometimes ironic. It's that when there's a chance of irony happening, it will happen. The contractor whose house is completely unrenovated because he never does it himself. The guy who teaches family mentorship and has a broken family at home. Why is that? And you, I feel like you're touching on it a little bit. It's like when we're trying to grip the stick too hard, we call it in Canada anyways, like, or when we're trying to push too hard.
I love that. So Canadian. I love that.
It seems to like... When I sense irony could happen in my life, I walk the other way. And I'm like, this seems to, like, it's not a chance this could happen. I bet you it's gonna, because I've just seen a pattern this time and time again. And there's this, I don't know, there's a visual I've had for myself. I call it the Chinese finger trap syndrome, which is like, I've got my fingers in a trap and I can, like, my instinct is to pull, right? And use my might. And that is generally who I am as an entrepreneur. I will just use my force to get things done. And I actually could get my fingers out. They're just gonna end up super bloody and, like, torn apart. Yeah. But what I have to do, which is non-instinctual, which is to, like, push back in and, like, let go a little bit so the thing loosens up.
So, brother, this is, you know, just another beautiful insight in your listening. And thank you for sharing that. And I think you're, you know, I mean, look, I don't pretend to know much. The older I get, the less I feel I know about anything. But, you know, I do believe that this premise has been, you know, proven enough times that it would be foolish of me to look the other way. So there's two things about that, you know, I think stand out to me and remind me of the phrase, you know, that which we resist persists. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, anybody who's a, you know, a golfer or has ever, you know, played the game or even watched the game can understand this analogy. If you're standing on the tee box with a pond off to the right and you're just saying, you know, all right, man, just hit this anywhere but the water, just anywhere, be fine. As long as it doesn't go in the water, you know where that ball
goes in the water.
So what we focus on, we find, including the things that we don't want. And so when we're consistently focused on what we don't want, we're going to steer towards that. And when that includes the things within ourselves, when we say things like, well, don't be nervous, don't be this way, don't be that way, we're naturally inviting attention, creating attention, focus, and energy towards that very thing, and we create it. We do this in conversations with others. When we are concerned about a reaction, we start to hedge against the reaction and naturally invite the very reaction we're hoping to resist.
Somebody taught me this a long time ago, when you're leading other people, not to say don't do this, but tell them what you want them to do, because they don't hear the don't. And so they just hear the do this piece and they start to repeat that behavior. Instead, focus on what you want them to do.
Fair. Here's what I would say. If you hey, don't be offended, right? It's like, all right.
You're getting ready to be offended.
Right. 100%. Now, there's that. There's telling somebody don't naturally creates a point of resistance. That's fair. The only caveat to that of telling someone what to do is, I think that there's maybe a more elevated level of this leadership, which would be asking someone what they think they should do first. Mm. So yes, to your point, it's better than telling them don't, or stop or whatever. But at the same time, I think the elevated level of leadership becomes more conversational. Right. Like, what do you feel as next step? And one of the phrases that I love to teach and share with leaders for many reasons is to learn to say, look, I have some thoughts on this, but before I share mine, I want to hear yours. Yeah. And the reason that this is very important is, one, a lot of leaders like being thought leaders. They like having the best idea in the room. They like being in front and in charge. And so they have a natural tendency to want to say their thing first to get credit for it. If this is non-conscious, nobody listening is going to think that this is them, but trust me, it's in us. If you feel an urge to speak first, it's because you want to be significant. You want your idea to be noticed first, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you don't believe that this is true about you, just think back to your past and ask yourself, if you've ever heard someone else say the idea you were going to say, did you then go, oh, I was going to say that? That's the surest sign that you care about getting credit for your ideas. Right. All right. So with that said, leaders love to give their ideas first. Oftentimes, entrepreneurs, especially, because they go first, they go into a space that no one else went into. They go into a business that no one else went into. So learning to just say that, which helps to satiate that desire to go first without actually giving the ideas, because once you put your ideas out there as a leader, you've now put constraints on what others feel they can say.
Do you know the situational leadership model? Do you know that little? Okay. It's something, again, this was something I learned when I was really young, but what you're talking about is supportive leadership. And so there's highly directive, which is I don't know anything. I just started here. You need to teach me. And so that's when you're telling exactly how and when to go do something. Then there's coaching, which is a little bit more, I'm still going to kind of tell you what to do, but I'm going to let you know why, so that you understand the context to all the things that are going on around you. And you can start to be more critical thinking in the way that you go about the tasks that you do. And then you get to what you're talking about, which is supportive leadership, where you're no longer answering their questions. Their confidence is usually low because they're used to asking you all the time for the answer, and you're trying to wean them off of that and show them that they have the ability to do it themselves. And so you're not answering their questions anymore. You're replying with a good question for them to think through, for them to come to you with the answer. And then finally getting them to delegation, which is their ability to autonomously do this without even coming to you for anything. And you're building them up, and not a person, but it's the skill that they're in. So it could be the skill of sales or the skill of administration or the skill of leadership, and you're working them through different styles of work, like supportive delegative coaching, based on where they're at in that one skill.
That's I again love that. What was it called?
Situational leadership. You can Google it. It's all over the internet.
I'll grab that. That's fabulous, because that framework is super helpful. Conceptually, explaining to someone that people at different points in their career might need different styles is fine, but that's a really, really helpful model. Yeah, that's great. And the only thing I would say in there is just be careful of the tendency to still immediately assume that you know where someone is at and not still give them the chance to think it through themselves and explore their own ideas on it. Because two things I think that can come out of asking someone very green what they think is next. And by the way, I completely support the premise. This isn't disagreement. This is just an and premise that someone who's completely green, still asking them, hey, well, so I know you don't know, but if you did, what would you say? Mm-hmm. What would you guess? it does a couple of things. One, it lets you access how they think and start to understand just on their own how they problem solve, how they think, you know, what they're up to. Secondly, it creates a space where they now know that they have the freedom to guess, to put ideas out there and not be, you know, smacked down because it was the wrong idea or the wrong answer. And by the way, as I say that, as so often occurs, you know, I had just hired a new team member who came on board, and she was surprisingly green. I thought she was further along in maybe some of the just alignment or understanding of her roles and responsibilities than she was. And now that I think of it, I completely failed to do this with her. And I was very sharp with my, I need you to do this, not do this, et cetera. And she, we only made it a month and she stepped aside. And I think it probably is for the best for what we need, for what she needs, et cetera. But man, I'm just feeling very humbled right now as I think about giving that coaching advice and how much I didn't use it in the last week. Just very eye-opening for me.
Do you want to know all the things I did wrong last week? I can list them, well, if you like.
That's one of my favorite phrases in my coaching. I say that's good advice. You should take that. I'm not going to use it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Keith, what we've talked about today is a lot of just around leading others, a little bit of leading ourselves actually as well. Is there any other just insights when you have what we've been talking about for the last little while is how to bring the best out of your people, how to help your people realize their potential is kind of a good way to put it. Is there any other just tools or thoughts that we should add to this conversation?
Of specifically that? I'd love to. One of the things that's really important, you know, as we look at like the way that we map and relate to other human beings is that in order for a human being to experience anything, right, we have to put a label on it. And so, you know, I mean, the great question, you know, I've been reading David Diane Fisher's book, The Map, which is a fabulous book for personal development and growth. Extraordinary. One of the best I've ever read. He talks about, you know, it's the chicken or the egg, like which came first? Did the results in our lives come first and then we used labels to describe them, or did we speak these labels and then the results followed? Well, it's a philosophical conversation, but I certainly have my opinion on it. And, you know, in order for us to experience anything, we have to put a label on it, right? That's how human beings relate to the world around them and create meaning out of everything. Yep. And so with other human beings, we tend to put labels on them. And then now, if you go back to the science that we started with, the reticular activating system, once we've decided that something is a certain way, now we've charged the non-conscious with finding evidence of it being that way, which, by the way, includes us.
We reinforce that opinion and we find the proof for it because now that's what we're looking for versus the other.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're scientifically wired to do this. Like we are instinctually wired to do this. So this is not an opinion. This is truth, which is why every single person has to know, I believe, that they are biased. And that's what confirmation bias is. Yeah. We will continue to find evidence to support our beliefs, always in perpetuity until we intentionally seek otherwise. So you shared this premise. Did you want to jump in?
No, I just want to say, how do we do it? How do we fix this? Yeah.
Yeah. I saw you maybe about to tell you, take a breath there. So what we have to be aware of is that once we label people, and I would even be careful of that word potential. I actually offer instead full possibility. Possibility is endless. Potential suggests that somebody isn't being their best self. Well, everybody's doing the best that they know how at any given point in time. As much as we don't want to believe that, it's true that there's something going on inside of us that causes us to show up the way that we do, that is just who, it's our best and it's their best. And so this idea of possibility, though, is beautiful. And I'll give you this example because my dad lived it. He didn't teach it. He lived it. And I now can see that in all of my studies. But my dad was a public school teacher for 35 years. He taught seventh grade English in Arlington, Massachusetts. And in 35 years, that man never complained about a student. Okay. Now we're talking about seventh grade, like adolescent, preteen.
I've got a
public school. These are the worst people on earth, Danny.
I just walked my 10-year-old through her grade six middle school, and I'm looking around being like, oh, good Lord.
You were probably scared to be there.
I'm choosing to send her here. Like, this is a choice I'm making.
The 12 to 15 year old, you know, whatever. These are the meanest people on earth, right? Like, so, and here, my dad somehow never complained about a student. And I would end up playing Legion baseball, Arlington Legion baseball in Arlington when I was 17 years old with a lot of my dad's former students, which would be very scary potentially for some kids. Wasn't for me, because my dad was everybody's favorite teacher. And, you know, there were kids on that team that got C's and D's in his class and still told me that he was their favorite teacher. Right. And here's the thing about my dad. Like, my dad simply saw the best in people. And so as a result, all people experienced was being seen at their best in his presence. Mm-hmm. And so when he passed away a year ago from Alzheimer's, you know, even in the remaining as this man who had mastered the English language was no longer able to even, you know, share the simplest thought, he still somehow saw and brought out the best in people. And at his funeral, everybody in that audience had the same thing to say to me. Like, you know, Uncle Denny or Dad or, you know, Dennis was my favorite. But what made him everybody's favorite was that everybody got to be their best version of themselves in his presence. What it really was they were their favorite version of them when they were around him.
Keith, is this all the stuff that you're working on with all these people? This is what you're up to. You're proving that you can't rule with an iron fist. You're proving that people have emotions and feelings, and they have perceptions of themselves and others. And you're breaking into that. Is this the work that you're doing every day?
For sure, this is the work. I think the only thing I might see differently, I don't think I'm proving anything other than I'm just sharing.
You're helping others see it, I would say.
I hope so. I mean, I believe that this premise of ethical influence, this idea of how do we influence people in a way that honors and sees them, and this idea that all human beings get to be is as we choose to see them. That's all they get to be. You're the author of your experience of that other person. And that person gets to experience themselves through your experience of them. And so when we're seeing them as not working to potential, you know, not buying in, not getting it, like that they need this or they should be listening to me or whatever else, we're diminishing that other human being in a particular way. So if you want big things from people, you have to see them as big. Mm-hmm. You can't see someone as small, i.e. not working to their potential, and then expect and demand them to be big.
You're creating your own reality. You create your own reality every day.
At all times and in every moment.
And it's not mystical and kind of wooey. It's that there people perceive how you're seeing them and show up exactly that way. And that's mirroring what you see.
And so to that point, like, this is why whenever I share a concept, a premise with people, I share it in a particular framework. It's concept, science, story, application. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you focus on, you find. What you focus on grows bigger. What you focus on, you become. Okay, concept. Science, reticular activating system. 11 million bits of data per second in the non-conscious being filtered down to 50 bits of data in the conscious mind for our awareness. You know, story. You know, if you've ever bought a new car, you shop for a car, you thought about that car, you research that car, you decide on the make, the model, the color, there's particular pattern, and then you bought it, and then what magically has shown up every day on the road since you bought that car, but that car all around you, right? And then I ask people in America, I say, you know, do you notice your car? Do you notice the, you know, the Honda Civics? And, you know, the number one car sold in America for the last 20 years. Nobody noticed the Civics except for the Civic drivers. But people would absolutely believe that their, you know, Mercedes A-Class is actually, you know, AMG is more common than a Honda Civic. Like, they'd actually think that because that's what they experience. That's what you look for.
As soon as I bought a Jeep, I saw Jeeps everywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's 10 to 1. It's not even close. In fact, I had such a funny, I used that example from stage the other day. The guy specifically had bought a Jeep. And then he said back to me, there were 150 people in the audience. He said back to me, he goes, but everybody drives a Jeep. And I just said, please raise your hands if you drive a Jeep in this room. Three hands went up.
Wow.
And it was the perfect example of how the mind works. So there's the science. And so, you know, look, I am woo-woo. I do believe in the mystical. I do. I mean, I go, you know, annually and sit with the shaman in Costa Rica. And, you know, I do explore.
There is something more. There is something more, and you're tapping into it.
Yes. And the science, though, also proves it.
Right.
It's just a matter of how willing you are to keep exploring the science. And so this is why I say, be an open-minded skeptic, be a curiously minded skeptic if you want. But at every level, the science continues to prove these things to be true. What you focus on, you find. How you see somebody is all that they get to be. And you know, unfortunately, we have an ego, which... I shouldn't say unfortunately. The shamans say your ego is your amigo. But we have an ego that's obsessed with being perfect. Mm-hmm. And so what it will do is put things in a box to make sure that we're always right. Because that's perfection. Now that said, the ego wants to be right, but the soul wants to be free. And so we are both. Right. We are a soul with an ego. And so we have this... human play. Battle,
yeah,
to constantly be, you know, either free or right, and rarely do those two things coincide. And so that's where the curiosity to explore has to, you know, if you want to experience this true sense of authenticity, this true sense of being yourself in the world, then you have to let go of the need to be right all the time.
That is the design of life, isn't it? There's contrast in life. Everything is contrast, and it's designed that way even, which is really interesting. And so, yeah, the one thing I've always tried to do is just like, I'm not going to embrace good times or embrace good things and try and get rid of bad things. I just want to embrace it all equally and see like what comes from it. And I'm so Keith, I'm a Christian. So my outside spiritual beliefs would be that. And I very much see, you know, life outside of the reality that we live in. And I've always just believed like, man, like I need to embrace all the good and the bad in this world equally and not try and shun the bad, because I need to experience that contrast to truly understand things. And in that contrast, I will get to define myself and make decisions for who I end up becoming. But if I'm always trying to push away and ignore the hard stuff and just go after all the good, easy things, I'll never get to evolve as a person, as a soul.
It is so good. And Danny, I think that there's a couple of things to consider with that, though, that can be watch outs. Okay. Like some distinctions within what you said, at least from my perspective, that sure. I think are worth sharing. That on the one hand, like, yes, don't, if we're constantly seeking feeling good, this becomes a very dangerous, and hand up, this, if anyone can speak from this. It's the pain and damage I've caused in my life to myself and others from what was an unwillingness to feel bad and sad for a long time, and constantly seeking ways to numb or avoid pain. And, you know, whether it was alcohol or drugs or sex or all the different, you know, human feel goods that would give us the chemical and the hit, God knows I chased them all, and still am challenged by it and still struggle. So your point to sit in and feel pain, sadness, loneliness, fear, you know, all the stuff like the not being enough, not doing enough, not worthy, not love, all that is, I do believe, the most important work we can do as a human being. The distinction I would offer is we have to be careful not to dwell on the negative. Like, That yes, sit and receive, but also not dwell and put all of our focus there, because we already know what that then does.
We become it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we find it and we become it. And it's, you know, it's why people who consider themselves lucky, you know, actually experience more luck, so to speak, because they're looking for, they believe this about themselves. Things are going to turn out my way. And then what do you know? They do. So, you know, there's a distinction in there to say, learning to sit with and breathe through fear, discomfort, especially, I think is probably the most important lesson I can speak for myself that I never learned. And I'm trying and working very hard to learn these days. But also dwelling on the negative will just make life seem that way. And so there's got to be a healthy distinction between the two. Sit with and move and feel it in your heart. Let your body feel it. And then have a conversation with self where we say, now, is that true? Right? Are these fears about yourself true? Are these fears... You know, what story is that that comes from our childhood, that comes from our belief system about self and our identity? And if we're willing to breathe and then move through that in a conversation and a reassurance, and the term that I hear best is called reparenting. This idea of actually becoming the voice to ourselves, to our little kid that's inside of all of us that we didn't have. You know, and if you think about Danny, your own example where you shared that, you know, maybe there was a lack of mentors and it sounds like, you know, maybe male influence in your life early on, being the dad to yourself that you did not have. Right. Like that's the work of now moving into a higher consciousness as an adult.
It's so interesting for me. I'm trying to be the dad I didn't have to my kids, but I'm not being the dad I didn't have to myself. I'm actually being the dad I didn't have to myself, like I'm being the dad I had to myself. I have the opposite. I noticed this when we finished our prep call. Me and you have very different perspectives, but we're both very extreme people in life. And this is one of these contrasts I'm noticing. Like I struggle to sit in the good and accept it. I almost feel like I don't deserve it. But I have no problem reveling in the chaos and the hard because I feel like I'm achieving something or I feel like I'm becoming a better version of myself through the challenge. And so I always seem to seek challenge and hardship. Not that I physically love it. It's hard, but it's where I feel alive. Yeah. And when I am sitting with my kids in the hot tub and we're just reminiscing and talking or playing a board game together, I have this weird, uncomfortable feeling. I don't feel like I should be sitting in that. I feel like I don't deserve it.
Danny, would you be willing to spend a little time here?
Sure.
For a moment on a personal level? Yeah.
Yeah.
So first of all, like just deep gratitude for you sharing that. Like really felt that too. You know, for you, when I think about, all right, so here, let's satiate the skeptics out there real quick. Okay. And we'll just share this from a scientific standpoint. What we know is that 80 to 90% of a person's personality and character is fully formed by the age of 8. All right. So imprinting occurs by the age of 8.
So my 7-year-old, I've got 1 year and everyone else is screwed, my kids.
That's exactly. Okay. That's the joke I usually make from stage. I go, so if you have a 9-year-old who's kind of a dick, you know, it's too late. Like you got to make a new one, start all over. Yeah.
Okay.
This is, the premise here is that what we think, Danny, how old are you now?
38.
What you'll often do is think of yourself as a 38-year-old version of you. Like at 38, I know these things, I should be here, this should be true and everything else as though you're a 38-year-old running the system. But the reality is that the vast majority of the way that you think, experience and believe the world to be and yourself to be was all formed by the 1 through 8-year-old version of you. Mm. You know, you said that you see people as stick figures. Mm-hmm. I see people as just full grown children.
Right.
Because the truth is that what we are is at 38 years old, you have to remember that you're also 1 through 38-year-old version of Danny. And you're most heavily influenced and informed by the version of the world that 8-year-old Danny knew the world to be. My guess is that 8-year-old Danny, being raised on welfare by a single mom, probably didn't know that life is supposed to work for him, that he's supposed to enjoy things, that life is going to be you know, easy and come this way, and you know that he's going to be safe and that everything's okay. Mm-hmm. You can feel free to tell me if that's mistaken or add to it. But what are your thoughts? 100%.
This is and I've brought it up on a few other podcasts now because I think I'm ready to talk about it actually, which is like, I don't naturally feel safe.
And literally the most critical desire that we have, the most instinctual need we have as human beings is to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so now if you look back and you say, you know, when you were 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, like, what did you have to do to be okay?
So in the beginning, I would run. I used to run away. And then when I turned about 12, 13, I learned how to work and how to work through the problem and how to fix it by sheer hard work and determination. And that's what stuck with me into my entrepreneurship side of me, into my career.
So those are your two imprints, yeah?
Yep.
Right. So assume that those two beliefs still run the show. If it's dangerous, hard, uncomfortable, unsafe, run away and work. Yep. Run away and get to work.
Yeah.
So I can imagine, but it's safe to assume that pattern still shows up, or what are your thoughts?
I tend to run towards challenge now and conflict and hard things. And when I know something's going to be bad, I actually kind of want to like pick up the phone and start with the issue right away because I want to solve it. But the hard work thing, it's definitely a pattern that it's like to this day. I took coaching for 2 years just to be more present and to not run and through like pure hard work and to find more peace in myself. So, and I've noticed in doing this work, I'm like, I'm not alone in this. Like, and this is why I think it's totally appropriate to talk about it in the show. Cause I'm like, I think a lot of the people we work with, I think a lot of the entrepreneurs out there, not all, but I think a lot of them feel this exact same way. And we don't address it. We just, again, put our head down and work through it.
So if unsafe, I imagine unsafe also included not having enough.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm guessing if you ran away that there was probably some serious danger involved as well.
I perceived danger. I'll say this. I had a really good mom who raised me through all this chaos in my life. And she wanted the best for me. And I think I wanted to be seen or heard. So I thought through running away, I would get attention maybe in a way. So.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And if mom is like, first of all, shout out mom. She's still with us.
She's passed on actually. Yeah.
Yeah. When was that?
Right before we started Breakthrough Academy, right before the start of this whole business actually that we run today.
Yeah.
And actually to your point, instead of dealing with some of that grief, I started this business and it became the thing that I ran towards. And ran away from the pain of the loss.
Exactly. And that's what I want. That's exactly amazing. Okay. Because you might think that it's running towards the hard thing, but what it's running away from is the f-ing loneliness, dude. Mm. The aloneness. Right. And brother, no. So first of all, we're not even meant to be raised by two parents. We're meant to be raised in a f-ing village.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree
with our cousins and our uncles and our aunts and everybody there to look out for us. With no need to perform or be anything, just to be.
Yeah.
That's how we're meant to be raised. This idea of the, you know, the immediate family, like, you know, and two parents is already a you know,
it's a broken version. That's the Western division, version.
Yeah.
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 I agree.
It's not even the one that we're meant for. And so then you take one of those two people out of the equation and then you put the need to provide and to have money and to have all of the things to be able to even survive and live, not even thrive, just to be okay. And you think about that dynamic and now you think about, you know, a 7, 8-year-old version of self, this little kid just so desperately wanting the attention that should be showered upon him from a dozen tribe members, but he's trying to source it all from mom. And let's not forget that mom is just a child herself, right, with no instruction manual
Child wearing an adult suit. When you told me that, this is what I pictured, like these adult suits that all these kids are wearing. Yeah.
Yeah. Just think of like the little kids, you know, like the from the movies with like standing on each other's shoulders to, you know, in a suit and a trench coat, trying to appear to be adults, because that's what this is. That's what this is. So you think about all of that, dude, and that's where you can see your pattern, right? So run away from the discomfort, from the aloneness, you know, from the not enoughness, right? Do something to get that attention. Well, you know, thank God you had mentors in your life that showed you that there were other paths to get that attention, to be enough. And of course, you've been incredibly successful and you are positive and you're doing all these beautiful things in the world. But brother, I can tell you, at least from my seat, that I spent my 20s, 30s very similarly, not the same upbringing by any stretch. Some people, you know, most people end up in therapy because they didn't get hugged enough. I say I ended up there because I got hugged too much. I used to tell my mom that she put the mother in smother. So different problems, same generative issue for me. I'll just share this in the hopes that it's meaningful for you or a listener, but my constant need was for external validation. Constant need for external validation. So I built everything around me to prove that I was enough. And no matter how much I got, it was never enough. Right. And so what I never learned was to be enough for self from self. Never. And God bless my parents. They didn't have that either. They didn't know how to do that either. And so my pattern became to build this, you know, to be adored, to be admired by the many in the coaching training. Now, is that a good thing? Sure. It's brought a lot of good to the world. I have thousands of people who have told me that. Yet no matter how many tell me that, I'll never be enough for self until I can come from self. And Danny, if you look, no matter how much, and I can't tell you how many of these entrepreneurs I'm working with who are in this discovery right now, who have received their 100, 110, 120, 150, $200 million checks, and they're like, I'm still not enough. Mm-hmm. Or I'm still not safe. I'm still not okay. I'm still not worthy. I'm still not lovable. I'm still, dude, and that's what I'm seeing. That's what I'm feeling. And that's the work that I'm in. And that's the work that I'm inviting people into with me.
Is it fair to say that there's a time in life, let's call it late 30s, 40s, maybe 50s, where this conversation has to come up for every person, basically? Like, people might call it a midlife crisis, but it's like this time where you're like, look, man, like Keith, you had the exact opposite upbringing than I had. And we still have what we might call trauma or things to work through in our adult lives. And is this just our brain getting to a point where it's time to address it? And there are those who do, and there are those who don't and suppress it. And that starts to define who we become in our older life. And this is like a crossing of the guard for a lot of us to kind of, I call it maturing, I guess, but it's like to kind of reflect on this stuff properly, because I find there's people that don't, and they just become sour and they become negative and they stew in their stuff and they repeat their patterns forever. And then I find there's people I meet like you who are very introspective and very reflective, and it doesn't make it any easier, but like we're a lot more aware of it and we're stepping through it in a different way.
So you started the question with, you know, is it fair to say that everybody, I don't know. But it does seem to me that most of my friends are in this moment themselves. Most of the people around me of similar age or of similar experience right now. Now that could be because I attract or am attracted to people that are willing to, and in this work, you know, so that could be it. But there's, I think certainly it would seem that all of us have this deep, you know, a need for, you know, Tony Robbins talks about the six human needs, you know, this sense of not enough, not worthy, not love, you know, not lovable, that is inherently within us from childhood, and that most of what we learn, because very few of us are raised by parents who are so enlightened that they're able to give to us the gift of self-regulation, autonomy, thinking for self, just being, that as we go into adulthood, we find a million different ways to distract from that discomfort. Some good, some bad, as far as the effect on us as humans. But that if we never learn to just do this inner work, this healing, that yes, it becomes, you know, wildly destructive. And I think people see this so often in their relationships because, you know, marriage is an incredible mirror for these wounds. And, you know, I look at my own failed marriage and the divorce that I'm still going through, financially anyway. And man, I look at it and I can see that all of my complaints, all of them about my ex-wife, were actually internal wounds that I wasn't able to heal and deal. And you know, if I could blame her, and most people, you see, they split and it's always their ex, right? It's always the ex. The ex was a narcissist. I have friends
divorcing right now, and it's like every time they come over, all they have to say is something about, and we're friends with both of them. So they, both of them are doing it to each other. And I'm like, guys, like, they're your ex. Of course you're going to feel that way. I don't think it's fully accurate, although some of it might be, but like, you need to point back at yourself too, bro.
I have a discovery in this process. I had to, in the middle of a divorce last year, I officiated a wedding for my friends. It was one of the most emotionally painful lifts of my life to both be like losing the love of my life. Well, or a love of my life, you know, the one who was supposed to be the one, losing that while simultaneously walking with these friends through their commitment. Yeah. I was literally filling out divorce documents in the morning and writing the sermon in the afternoons. And it was an incredible moment of reflection. But one of my key takeaways from that I shared with them during their wedding was, whenever you're absolutely certain that it's the other person, that's when you can be sure that it's you.
Right.
When you are with total conviction and certainty that it is the other person, that's when you can be sure that it's you. And I'm even willing to go out there and say the most extreme scenarios. And it's because there's something in us that's matching and attracting and bringing that person into our life or whatever, or bringing that forward to us. And I can see so clearly now how much, you know, the desire where I wanted to be acknowledged and I wanted more credit and I wanted, you know, all of these things. I wanted to be respected and all of this that I was looking for and saying, you, it was me the whole time, but I couldn't see it in the moment, man.
There are friends I need to send this sound clip to really badly that need to hear this right now. So thank you for sharing that, Keith. That's
And you know, in that way, maybe only, you know, this may be a great gift to me, right? That this humbling of loss and, you know, Danny, that, in an 18-month stretch, I lost my mom, you know, my dad got Alzheimer's, he passed away, and I said goodbye to my wife and my dog for my dad's funeral. That was, it was as my coach at the time said, she was like, you've had a PhD in loss over the last 2 years. And that's, it was a lot and, you know, almost too much, for me, cause I almost couldn't make it through. I mean, you know, it was deeply suicidal and in ideation and couldn't sleep. And I mean, just enormous, enormous grief and pain, but it was so humbling. And to sit with it and to let myself be sad and to cry, and there's still more to be done. Unfortunately, I'm not done with the sadness, not even close, but to sit with it, these have been great gifts in humbling and becoming softer and a little bit more compassionate and a little bit more gentle in the world, you know, because up until then I had figured out how to make everything go my way. And that was, not healthy.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous to have too much success for too long because you feel like you're invincible and you don't know how to deal with transition like this. Keith, I want to ask you this, and we probably should end at some point. I know you got an appointment to make. So when we were prepping, there was one thing you said to me that I wanted to come back to, and I think this is what you're talking about right now. I asked you, like, what are you working on these days? And you said, I'm learning how to breathe. And I was like, What do you mean by that? Because it sounds like what we're talking about right now. Can you explain that? Because there's a lot of people that have gone through exactly what the two of us are talking about, and you're working through it right now. I would just love to get a snapshot of what you're working on.
I'll mention his name again, David Dayan Fisher, is out of all the authors and speakers on the topic that I've found, I am most resonant with his work right now. And that even included signing up and getting to have a call with him. And he was as remarkably present and insightful as he appears to be in his Instagram clips and everything else. And it's his book, The Map, that I've been reading. I have sought every version of self-development that you can basically seek in this life. I mean, Landmark Forum, Tony Robbins, World Legacy, you know, Fierce Conversation. I've gone to, you know, I I've drank, you know, all the ayahuasca and, you know, mushroom therapy and psilocybin and MDMA and all of it. Right. And, you know, he points it out. And again, talk about painful things. He said he referred to that yoga, breath work, all of it. He said it's just spiritual bubble gum. That's his term for it. Spiritual bubble gum. It makes you think that you're on some road to enlightenment, but the real work is moment to moment, minute to minute, and day to day. And it's learning to breathe. To realize that the nervous system has been regulated, dysregulated since you were a child, most likely. And so whether it's the experience of chaos and hard work that creates a feeling, or the constant anxiety that I'm doing it wrong, right? And as a result, I'm going to pay for it. Yeah. Which is my own internal dialogue, whatever it is. If you get honest and you find it and you see it, you're going to discover that that pattern will recreate itself over and over and over and over again, because the nervous system is wired to want it, to need it. And so although the content may change over the years, there may be different actors on stage, there may be different circumstances, the bank account might have different numbers in it, all the content can change, but the context remains the same. We're creating the same feeling and the same pattern over and over and over again. We're just inviting new players into the play. And so the breathing that we do is the regulation or dysregulation of the nervous system. And as human beings, we've been wired for millions of years to breathe a certain way, depending on our experience of danger. Now, when we were growing up on the plains, danger was being eaten by a cat. It was only when we were in danger that we moved into fight or flight. But in the modern world, we experience fight or flight all the time. We experience it through social anxiety, through not enoughness, through comparison, through a manager calling us in, through getting fired, through the fear of getting fired, through a promotion, through all the different things. Now we experience fight or flight constantly. And nobody's taught us that literally what that is a nervous system reaction, and we need to learn to breathe through. And there's a beautiful saying that no problem can be solved at the same state of consciousness at which it's being experienced, which means that if you're in an anxious space, you're going to ruminate, you're going to continuously loop, 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 loop through that while you're shallow breathing, which means you're in the same state, which is trying to fix a broken piece of glass with the same hammer that you broke it with. And so the work now is to catch it and literally breathe. Slow the breathing, take deep breaths, and then start a new conversation with the internal self, with the child that's showing up in that moment, and go, oh, buddy, you're feeling like you're not enough, like you just did it wrong. Oh, buddy, you're feeling like you're not safe, like this isn't okay and you need attention. And what Fisher taught me, instead of immediately going to the parenting of being like, hey, you're wonderful, you're this, you're that, because he goes, that's the same parenting you were getting, being told you were perfect when you were perfect. You know, like, how about you just stop and ask that little kid inside you, that inner voice inside you, okay, what are you feeling right now? And brother, I've been amazed at the answers. You know, I'm feeling scared that I'm going to be alone. I'm feeling like I'm not enough. I'm afraid I'm going to die, literally.
Right.
Those are answers that are coming back to me. Oh, hell, okay. I understand. Now, is that true? I know that's an old story. That's not real. We're no danger in this moment. We're actually okay. Breathe.
You're literally moment parenting to moment, yourself. You're literally
minute to minute
speaking to your younger self.
That's it.
I've done a little bit of this actually, and I've been writing to myself. I've been writing my younger self to my current self, and then I wrote my older self to my younger self. And I did a little conference where we did this, and they had a ChatGPT generated image of the old version of me, and I stared at it while it wrote to the me of today. And there was some healing in that. There was some, yeah, and it's what you're speaking to. You're communicating with the different versions of yourself that are inside your brain jumping around. And you're right about that reeling. I feel like that it's a death spiral of reeling that creates this anxiety over time. So
it's remarkable. And as whatever the familiar feeling is, we will continue to create it. We'll just add new components to create the same feeling over and over. I can certainly speak to that as my experience.
That's massive. Because a lot of people, especially when you talk about some of those dollars, a lot of people are like, once I hit that, then I'll be fine. And it's a lie.
Yep.
And I know it's a lie because I came from nothing. And I was like, once I have a business, once I have some savings, once I have a house, and it's never ended. And it's becoming a pattern that I'm starting to realize even for myself. I'm like, this is a truth that this is a lie. And I need to fight this lie because it's never going to end otherwise. Yeah.
Can I share a last thought story with you? Okay. So ayahuasca may be misunderstood. I don't know what your familiarity with it is.
Yeah,
it's an ancient Amazonian medicine. And it's what it is, thousands of years, the shaman have been drinking it. And it's a bark and a vine that they, you know, mix together, creates DMT. And essentially what it does is it blocks conscious processing and allows you total access to your non-conscious, which is, you know, in their way of thinking, total access to like your God's consciousness. So collective consciousness. Basically, the concept is Mother Ayahuasca, it's a medicine, it will heal you. And the way that it heals you is by releasing trauma that's trapped in the body. And we know this now to be true. If you want a book on trauma that's incredible, it's The Body Keeps the Score, which is a remarkable book about the fact that we actually store trauma, pain in the body, not the mind. You know, PTSD has even been shown now to not be it's not a psychological disorder, it's a physiological disorder. Okay. So now, like so many things, this thousands-year-old tradition makes sense in modern medicine. Well, essentially what happens when you're on it, one of the ways that the healing occurs is through vomiting, through purging. And it's a psychosomatic effect. You have a new discovery. You see something, you experience something, and the next thing you know, you start vomiting into a bucket that you're given, right? So the last time I went through this experience, and by the way, it's beautiful work. It's not the work itself. It's part of the work, but it's really showing you what you need to work on. So I have this experience where I start to see all the ways in which I've been desperately seeking love throughout my life, all the way back to, of course, my mom, the OG, you know, who I was always trying to be enough for, right? And that's how she knew to parent. So I have this incredible discovery that like I've always been seeking acknowledgement and validation outside of me, especially from women. And I'm just thrown up into this bucket and I'm having this, you know, purging situation, right? And I come to this, incredible moment of discovery where I had always known that like, no matter what, I had this bottomless pit of the need for validation. No matter how much I got, as soon as the last note of an I love you had you know, disappeared, I was like, but what about now? There was no amount of validation that was ever enough. I knew this, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I'm sitting there and I'm just suddenly having this incredible discovery of this need and everything else, but I'm purging it out. And I look down at this bucket and I'm like, oh, I finally found the bucket that I can fill with my need for validation. So I have this like kind of comical discovery because, you know, God's very funny. And I have this comical discovery and I go, okay, I'm going to bring home a clean bucket. And from now on, when I need validation or when I do something I'm proud of, I'm going to write myself a note and I'm going to put it in the bucket. Right. And then I'm going to learn to become my source of my own validation. So I bring this bucket home and I start writing myself little love notes and putting them in the bucket. And you know, it's a beautiful little process, really sweet kind of takeaway of learning to be enough for myself from myself. And Danny, I have cleaning people that come in once every couple of weeks. I come home one day and I look in the bucket and they'd emptied the bucket.
Because they thought it was a trash can.
They thought it was a trash can. No. And if you can't appreciate the cosmic comedy, God's sense of humor that I finally found my own source of validation, and it was immediately thrown in the trash. I don't know what the f- else you are doing in this life, because this look, man, there is enough pain to be felt in this life, and it should be, but good Lord, is this life hilarious too.
Dude, I'm telling you, life's ironic, and it's not ironic sometimes. It just is ironic. This is, I'm fully bought into this thought. Anyway, thank you for sharing, Keith. This was amazing. This is such a deep, long, kind of very heartfelt podcast that I appreciate you just bringing it, man. And yeah, all of you and just your personal insights, your personal experience, pulling some stuff out of me. Yeah, I appreciate this chat, and I'm glad we get to send this out to the people and see what they can take from it.
And to your people, as we discussed, I'll sign off as I always like to. And to you, Danny, I love you.
Thanks, buddy. I just met you, but I feel like I love you too. I feel a pretty good, cool heart connection to you. So what do you know? A bunch of good, tough dudes. We got some pretty soft hearts. I like it.
Indeed, we do.
All right, Keith. Have a good week. Thanks for, your time.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.